This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As political controversy and doping concerns dominate the headlines in the run-up to Beijing and the Olympic Games, some of us may be losing our faith in the power of purity and power and the purity of those the Olympic Games. My guest today has participated in sports as a player, a coach, announcer, scholar, and writer. Jan Boxall grew up playing football with her 11 siblings at a time when girls weren't even allowed to march in the band because it was considered too strenuous for them. Well, she went on to help found her college basketball team, later became a college coach. For more than 20 years, Jan served as public address announcer for women's basketball at UNC and was an announcer at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. Oh, and I forgot to mention her day job. Jan is senior lecturer and director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill, where she has written extensively on sports ethics and gender equity in sports. And Jan Boxall is in our studio today. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
It's really good to have you here. Let's go back to the beginning. Talk about growing up in Worcester, New York.
Well, Worcester, New York is a very little town, had 1,000 population and probably many more animals than it had people. And we lived on a farm up in the hills, and it was a dairy farm. And there were, as you pointed out, I have 11 brothers and sisters, 5 brothers and 6 sisters. And basically, most of our work was working on the farm, milking cows, putting in hay. And before you could milk cows, you did most of the little things like weed gardens and do dishes and sweep the floors and do all those kinds of things.
So this was one of those farms where you grew a little bit of everything and...
All of our food pretty much was grown on the farm. We had a huge garden. So to this day, I have no interest in having a garden and weeding any garden. So my friend plants flowers at my house, but I have no interest in weeding them. So we had fields and fields of potatoes, which we would eat and then harvest so that we would have them over the winter. And, as I say, all the vegetables and even the meat. Probably the few things we didn't have was when I was young, we made bread, but later on, making bread was not my thing.
So, and of course, you sold some of these crops, and there's a...
Mostly we sold milk, so it was a dairy farm, so that we would, as you know, you milk cows in the morning and you milk cows at night, and so the only cooling place that we had to keep the milk overnight was a cold water from the spring, which we would keep the milk cold.
And you probably have no interest in keeping cows anymore either.
No, but I do have a milk can out in front of my house.
Right? That's great. So now you're growing up on this farm, and your father is from Croatia, and
correct,
your mother was from Czechoslovakia.
Correct.
How did they meet?
They met in Illinois. My father was a coal miner, and in Eastern Europe, in Germany, in Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia during those times. And then a friend of his, I think, came to the States in early 1900s, and then he became not only was a coal miner, but then became sort of an organizer for the coal miners. And my mother apparently came over much later, and they met in Illinois at the coal mines.
So he started out as a miner, and as you say, was an organizer, but wasn't allowed to move to the top. John Lewis, he wanted to work for him.
He was. John L. Lewis contacted him about working as a translator, because apparently my father spoke almost all the Eastern European languages. And so, as you know, coal miners are mostly from Eastern Europe, and so John L. Lewis asked him to be his translator and interpreter. But my father at that point in Illinois had 6 kids and said he had to take care of the family. So didn't.
Didn't do that. When did he decide to buy a farm?
Well, a friend of his from the coal mines went to New York and found this land in Worcester. And then when he came back, said, come up and visit. And my father apparently did and never went back.
Did he have any experience farming before?
None whatsoever.
How old was he when he came over?
Let's see. He was born in 1988. I believe he came over just after World War I and in the 1915 or something.
So he was young. He didn't have any real experience.
No.
And then went into the coal mines. And now he's going to become a farmer.
Farmer, exactly.
And he's already got 6 kids.
He's already got 6 kids.
So it better work.
Right. So 6 were born in Illinois and 6 were born in New York.
Wow. And how about your mother? Any experience on a farm?
None. I don't. And I know so little about her. She, as you point out, she died in childbirth and on the 12th child when I was actually the day after my 3rd birthday.
You were 3.
I was 3. So I really have no recollection of her at all, which is too bad. But I do listen to, you know, some of my older
siblings.
What
did they say about her?
That she was a very, very hard worker. Right? And so everybody had to work on the, you know, doing farming with no amenities. But she did all the cooking, plus she did a lot of the farming, in particular the garden and so forth, but also milk cows. But all they do say that she was one of the hardest workers. She never did speak English, as far as I know. And my father spoke English but could not write English. And so I do remember things of working with him before he died that I would sort of do the bills because it was, you know, I don't know why I was doing them. But
well, and you lost your father when you were 12
years
old.
Right, just shortly after I was 12. And he was killed on the farm. We at that point had a tractor. And excuse me, some of his friends would say, those tractors are going to be the death of you someday, because we used horses, right? But the tractor, in putting up hay one night, flipped the rope. The track slipped, and the ropes tightened, and the tractor flipped over.
And you, at that time, there was only one younger sibling.
Two younger. Right.
So what happened to you? What happened to the family at that point?
Well, we stayed on the farm working until each one of us graduated. My father, unfortunately, wasn't expecting to die, and so there was no will. And so with 12 children and no will, it's very difficult. So we stayed on the farm with basically no adult supervision. My sister, who lived in the town, became our guardian.
And how old was she at that time?
She was probably 25, maybe, 24, 25. And so that was pretty tough for her, too.
I would guess, what was she expecting to do? Was she thinking about going off to college at that point?
No, she wasn't. I think, excuse me, I think she had already, she was married and lived in the town and had, in fact, the day he was killed, she had her first child. So she was actually... so that's how I know how old my nephew is. But because she was there, the rest of them had all gone away, living in New York someplace. And one had gone into the military, and she was married to a military officer. And my older brother lived near, but he was not really in any position. So Helen, my oldest, not the oldest, but the third oldest sibling, became our guardian. And she would come and visit, you know, every so often when there was trouble, which occasionally we'd have trouble, but not really.
No.
We would fight a lot, but nobody to the point that really would get hurt.
What were the expectations for you? What were your dad's expectations for you? Did you sense any? But you were young. He's got a big family. So, was there a sense that you should go to college?
No. The basic thing was to graduate high school. Right. So he didn't have a sense. I think from my understanding, he didn't have but an elementary education, and neither did my mother. And so college wasn't something that anybody thought about. I mean, we were dirt poor. Have you ever seen the movie Coal Miner's Daughter, where she says, you know, every August you would order from a mail order catalog? Well, that's exactly what we did. We lived by Sears catalog, and every year would order our shoes, and that were only could be worn at school, right? And certain clothes. Most of the clothes we would make from old remnants and so forth, like that.
Wow. And were you told just not to look at certain pages because you weren't going to get it?
Oh no, we would always look at them. Right? We knew we weren't going to get them. So, so college wasn't ever an option, even though I remember, you know, always wanting. But my main goal was literally just to get off the farm. I mean, it was, as I tell my students and I told my kids, you know, I never missed a day of school because it was a heck of a lot easier going to school. Wow. And I could go to a real toilet. So that was, and get warm in the wintertime because it's awful cold.
So what was school like, apart from all of those amenities?
School was fairly, not easy, but all work had to be done at school, study hall, studying, you know, all the homework. Because once you got home, you didn't have time really to do any homework. So what I did had to be done at school. But I loved school, except for certain, you know, courses. But I actually liked school. I got to go see people that I normally don't go to see. And I mean, when you think about farms, I mean, we had, which today is really a lot, and then was a lot. It was about a 250-acre farm, and so the next neighbor was a ways away.
Right.
And so the only time you would get to see those people would be, you know, when you help each other out, which we did occasionally, especially putting in corn, because you can't afford all those kind of equipment. So you shared. And when we would, as I say, clean off a field and play family football or family basketball, not basketball, family baseball.
So you said you had an impulse to go to college. Was that encouraged at all? How about teachers at school?
Teachers at school did, yes, I think. But I knew that, you know, there was not really scholarships available for girls. And so I knew that that wasn't an option, even though, you know, I did send away for information. And I remember one university, Rice, at the time, did not require, you know, if you got in, you didn't have to pay, you, there was no tuition. But, you know, you still needed more than that. You still needed to live on something.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had, you know, no money. And so the easiest thing for me was as soon as I was 18, which was I graduated at 17. So I had to wait till I was 18 and then I went into the military.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that, your military career, how you got to UCLA, and then what brought you to UNC. All of that on the way as our conversation with Jan Boxall continues. She's the director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill, but she's done a lot more than that. And we're going to hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking today with Jan Boxall. She is now senior lecturer and director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. Spends a lot of time writing and thinking about sports ethics and gender equity in sports. And we're talking about the fact that when you left the farm, you went right into the Air Force. But I want to know how important sports was to you by that time.
Well, sports was the one thing that was our entertainment. We didn't have television. We didn't have a telephone even until I was in high, sometime in high school. So we didn't have the usual things that people do for entertainment. So we did have a large family. And so what we would do is play sports, whatever was available. We would play baseball when we cleaned off a field in the summer. We would play football. And our football was using a salt box. Thank God for those salt boxes. And we'd put stones in it, and that would be our football. And we would play in the wintertime. My brother made some makeshift hockey sticks. And so we would use stones and use that for a puck, and no skates, of course. So we would just, so basically it was whatever was available that we could play. The other thing was music that we did. The school did offer us music lessons, and basically we were all pretty musically talented. And so I took saxophone lessons, and so we would play music at home as well. But the two biggest things were sports and music. And as I say, mainly because there was no money to do anything else. There was no, well, they didn't have movies. I think there was a movie in the town, but that was too far for us to go. I think I saw my first movie when I was in the Air Force, actually.
In the Air Force? Well,
yes.
I see. Didn't go to the Bijou or whatever.
No,
no. Well, so sports and music kept you busy. Did anybody ever think at the time, did you think that this might be a career for you in either?
No, actually not. I knew that I always, you know, I always felt and thought that I was pretty athletic, and I knew that I wanted to play sports, but there was no avenue for girls. And so, you know, you just did what you had to do. The one thing I had thought that I wanted to do mostly was teach, but I knew you had to go to college to teach. And so that was.
And of course, there was a financial obstacle. So you chose to go into the Air Force.
I did. The interesting thing is that I remember is that as wards, we were all wards of the court, right? Those of us under 18. And so, as wards of the court, girls had to report to the court until they were 21, boys till they're 18, unless they went into the military. And so I went to live with one of my sisters in Baltimore until I was 18, and then joined the Air Force from there. She had been in the Air Force. Her husband was also in the Air Force. And so it wasn't difficult for me to do.
And you spent 3 years?
3 years.
Where'd
mm-hmm.
you go?
Went, of course, where everybody in the Air Force goes. First, you go to San Antonio, where at Lackland Air Force Base first for training. And it's basically the first time, except I'd been to New York for my high school senior trip. That was basically the first time I'd really ventured too far out of Worcester. And so we went to basic training in Lackland for, I think it's 8 weeks. And then, you know, I had wanted to be a physical training instructor or radio operating, but radio operating wasn't available for females. And so one day the captain of the women's Air Force band came through the barracks and asked if anybody'd be interested in trying out for the band. And I thought, why not? So I did.
What'd you play?
I played saxophone.
Is it true that in high school they wouldn't let you in the band because girls?
We played in there. Well, we didn't have a marching band. No, it was at UCLA. After I got out of the Air Force, that we weren't allowed to participate in the marching band. So I participated in the concert band in high school a lot, right? And so, but I don't remember us even marching at all.
Mm. So,
oh, we did in the and we did in parades. Come to think of it, yes,
drum majors or that
yes.
kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And I guess the problem for UCLA was the girls just couldn't make it. It was just too hard.
What the
for
band
you.
Director said is girls can't walk and play an instrument at the same time.
Wow.
So. And I politely said I'd probably walked more miles playing an instrument than his whole band put together.
Because by then you'd been in the band. What was it like? So it's one thing to say, okay, look, I want to come out from under this court order stuff and mm-hmm. be in the Air Force. But now you've got to actually be in the Air Force.
That's
Were
right.
you ready for that? I mean, did it?
Actually, it was a cakewalk compared to working
wow.
on the farm. In basic training, I had my own bed. On the farm, we slept three in a bed. We had, instead of getting up and going to the work to milk the cows in the morning at 5 o'clock, at 5 o'clock, you go have breakfast and you don't have to make it. And you have, as I say, you have your own bed. It was warm and, oh yes, it was luxury compared to what I grew up in.
And your own saxophone.
And my own saxophone. This is true. This is true.
So then you decide to go to college because now
yes.
you can go on the GI Bill, right?
No, actually, when I first got out of the Air Force, the GI Bill had been suspended. And so from 60 to 65, I believe the GI Bill was suspended. And then it was reinstated in 64 or 65. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly what year. And that's when I took the GI Bill. And during that, before that, I had taken some classes at night school, working and going to Long Beach City College. And then once the GI Bill was reinstated, then I went to UCLA full time.
And what did you take there?
Undergraduate, I started out doing math and political science, but I was very politically active, and so, then I did philosophy. So I did political science, undergraduate, philosophy, graduate, master's, and PhD.
And what led you to philosophy?
I think it's not so far afield. I think I was mainly interested in political, I was right. seriously interested in the politics, but also in political philosophy. And I did a lot of the political theory, and then because at that time, I think my husband was also in philosophy. And I was working as an undergraduate work-study student in philosophy department. And so I got very much more comfortable in doing philosophy as well.
And talk about studying. It was more than just philosophy for you when you got married.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your husband, Bernie.
Bernie came to UCLA as a graduate student in 1965. And I was an undergraduate working in the department, and we met, invited him to dinner, and basically 2 weeks later, we knew we were getting married, and we got married at semester break in 1966.
And that all
married
made,
ever since.
That all made sense to you, but this is a mixed-race marriage in the
yes.
mid-60s, and it turns out not everybody was so cool with it.
No, not everybody was so cool with it. But the good part for us was that most of our friends were also mixed marriage, and so the kids, you know, got to see other mixed marriage kids. We did have an apartment owner and manager who was not happy with it, and he knew Bernie is fairly light, and I'm fairly dark, so that we're, you know, in the summertime in California, we kind of look alike, right? But the manager of the apartment knew that he wasn't white, right? And so, and he assumed he was black, but he wasn't so sure until we invited Bernie's roommate to dinner, and who's very dark, and he knew right away. And the next day, literally, we got an eviction notice.
Which weren't out for another 3 months
or
so.
We stayed there because Bernie was taking his PhD exams, and so, but it was not a comfortable thing. And we went to legal aid because that was the only thing we could afford to get some help. And she basically said, well, do you want to stay there? And I said, no, because this guy would know every move we made. And so as soon as I would come out of my door, this guy would come out of his door and just spit in mm-hmm. front of me. And occasionally would hit me. But I would go to school, you know, to UCLA, you know, basically very distraught every day. And so, we eventually did move from there.
So politics was for you at one point academic, and now it's becoming very much everyday life.
Correct.
Was that a shock for you, even though you had studied politics and you were drawn to it for whatever reasons?
It was. But on another note, I mean, growing up there on the farm, there were a few African-American families who were in the school. And, you know, nobody, I think everything seemed okay. I really don't know, because as a kid. But the interesting thing was that in the military, this was a women's Air Force band. That time it wasn't integrated till again after 1972, which we'll talk a little bit later. But I remember once that we had, that the captain had auditioned an African-American woman to participate, to join the band. And she didn't take her. She said, because we have to travel in the South and we couldn't do the things. And it was interesting. We did do a lot of traveling in the South. And it wasn't that it was, you know, stated that she couldn't be accepted. But I remember now, you know, the captain saying that the reason she wasn't taken was because, you know, we couldn't afford to have the South.
Yeah, it's different. And did you you also started the women's basketball team at UCLA?
I was part of a group that we wanted to play ball. Well, first I wanted to go into the band, right? So that was out for me.
But I figured, okay,
I was 3 years in the military and doing music, and so I thought, but I really wanted to play ball. And at the time, there was no real basketball team. And so a group of us got together, went to the athletic department and asked about starting a team. And they actually said, if you can do it, do it. So we went to the track coach, and she was our coach for many years. And at that time, it was three on three.
So you play the half court game?
Oh, yes.
Girls still do that in Iowa.
They just stopped.
Did they?
Just recently. Wow. Right. So girls couldn't cross the middle line. Then they had rovers. And then probably the last 2 years that I played, it was 5-on-5.
So that was because you're talking about UCLA basketball, and to imagine a time when UCLA didn't have a women's team.
Right. So now when I tell people I played at UCLA, in one way, that's kind of interesting, but in another way, it's nothing like what we have now.
Who are you? But you say there was no real resistance to starting a team.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And
of course, we didn't have the facilities, so we played in an old gym, but we had to, you know, work to get our own uniforms. We drove our own cars. We got $1.50. The school did give us $1.50 per diem when we would travel. But one interesting thing is that it was the women who actually opened up Pauley Pavilion. So rather than it was so,
wow. It was,
I forget the year exactly. But so Jabbar was there, and then Lou Elsendore. But the women would be allowed to play before the JV, because that was before freshmen could play varsity.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it would be the women, the freshmen, and then the varsity. And so we would play before the JV. And, of course, when Jabbar was there, everybody wanted to see Jabbar. So we did have people at our games.
It was quite a place. That's the place, of course, that where the UCLA varsity team plays, in Pauley Pavilion. So who were you playing? What was the landscape like for women's basketball?
Well, interestingly, other schools, and I think this is why it was easy for UCLA to adopt it, because other schools, Long Beach State, all the state colleges, Cal State LA, Long Beach State, Southern Cal, Santa Barbara. So there were lots of schools within driving range that we could actually play.
And now you're talking about L.A. in the mid-60s. You're studying political philosophy. You're living political philosophy and history. That's an interesting place to be.
It was a very interesting place to be. And, again, I was fairly active. My roommate, before I met Bernie, we had decided we wanted to be arrested. I don't know how stupid we were. She was also African-American, very similarly, like Bernie, very light-skinned, but... So what we would participate in civil rights actions. We would also be participating in the Vietnam presentations, and they had what would they call them, teach-ins. So, but it was an exciting time. I did get to meet and talk to Martin Luther King, which is probably one of the biggest things that's happened to me.
Tell me about that meeting.
And he was giving a talk at the base of Jan Steps, which is at UCLA. And there were lots and lots of people there. And I don't know whether we just, my roommate and I just decided to be bold and go up and wait after at the end and talk to him. And we did. And there was Elaine, who was my roommate, myself, and this person, Slaughter, Frank Slaughter, I believe. He was a law student. And we talked about things that he wanted to see and that we wanted to see. So it was actually not just a shake your hand. We actually did get a chance to talk.
Did you join the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee?
I did join the student SNCC. And I used to have all these paraphernalia. I don't have any of it now. But I had at one point thought of going to Mississippi. And I remember talking to a professor about going. And I think Elaine and I both were going to go. And then it was the same time of the Watts riots. And so we didn't go, and I think that was right after. Then I met Bernie right after that. But it was interesting. Stokely Carmichael would come often to UCLA, and I remember distinctly him saying, you know, we don't want racehorses, we want workhorses. And so if you're thinking something's going to happen tomorrow, it's not. You're in here for the long haul.
Were you thinking at the time, did you see the relationship between gender equality and racial equality?
I did. And the interesting thing came up with Stokely Carmichael, because he was not, women were to be, you know, sort of behind. And so that began to raise some issues. But of course, the band thing raised an issue right away for me. And so the fact that women couldn't participate in the marching band just seemed to me so wrong. And so I think in some of those ways, yes. I mean, it was clearly civil rights, but not just for, you know, for one group. But, you know, it meant everybody. And which reminds me of the freshman reading book that we're having at UNC this year called Covering. And, you know, you don't think in that people that cover, as he's talking about, you know, there's all kinds of civil rights issues that grow. But I think probably the two biggest is probably, you know, I was more concerned about African-Americans and then women.
Was it a moment, though, was there a moment for you when you felt that you had to, in a sense, raise awareness among civil rights leaders that at some point they were going to have to, you know, come to terms with this? I went because you're in the middle of it and it's at a very delicate stage, so you might not have.
No, that's right. And I think I wouldn't have known how to actually go about it. I was more one of those workhorses, yeah. I felt. And so, and I think at the time my concern was more with the racial injustices that were so much more prevalent, because after all, I was in school, right? And I did have some opportunities that others hadn't had, and I did see it in the military. And so I think the racial was much more prevalent in my mind at the time.
What were you hoping to do with all this? Where did you think it was going to lead?
I guess I had great hope with Martin Luther King, and I think that would lead to some changes, but I really didn't know. I just knew that I couldn't do nothing.
So, I'm going to find out what it is you did do, but I have to also point out that not only did you meet Martin Luther King, but also Arnold Schwarzenegger on Venice Beach.
Yes, I did meet Arnold Schwarzenegger on Venice Beach. and that came about because my husband was I don't know if he was actually a bodybuilder, but his best friend in St. Lucia, where he grew up, excuse me, Rick Wayne was his best friend, and Rick was about Mr. Olympia, Mr. Universe, and he was editor of the Weider magazine. And so I got to know a lot about bodybuilding, and of course they would work out at Venice Beach.
You should paint the scene for us, because that was quite a time.
It really was, and I didn't realize it until sort of now, because it's, Arnold, I know, still has, I think, a show. But in Venice Beach was Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, Frank Zane, and a whole bunch of others who would just always hang out together. And Arnold was an interesting character.
Yeah, people would just come to see them,
of course,
pose.
Mm-hmm. People would come to see them pose. And they would be working out, there's no question. And then they would work out at Gold's Gym, which is not the Gold's Gym of today, because Gold's Gym was owned by Joe Gold in Venice. And then he sold it as well as the name. So it's not quite the same as I think it was. But Rick would fill us in on a lot of the things. And I went to many, many shows. It was fascinating, to put it mildly.
Shows. Tell us about those.
The shows would be, you know, bodybuilding shows, and you'd have different categories. And Arnold, of course, being the biggest in the biggest category. Sergio Oliva was another big one, who was probably during the time of Arnold. But
it's just guys flexing their muscles?
Just guys. Well, they flex, but they do poses. Ah. And the poses is actually rather interesting, because now I think I've actually seen people do it to music. But you do the most muscular pose, you do the bicep pose, you do the abs pose, and the legs and the so forth. I've forgotten most of it. But my least favorite was the most muscular one, because they look like, you know, they're doing sort of an animal pose. But, you know, they look like the muscle, you know, when you see, if you're taking anatomy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You can see the ripple of the muscles. And the biggest thing were the cuts, right? I mean, a lot of them had large muscles, but it wasn't just a matter of having large muscles. You have to have cuts, so you have to be able to see the actual muscles.
The kind of topography of
yes,
the body.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And what now they call six-pack, but then my husband, we were talking last night about doing the rope, where you actually bring in the sides of your stomach and you can... The stomach muscle is, I think that's, I don't know, the abs muscle is a rope.
Did it shock you to see me doing all those warm-ups before the show?
Yes, it did.
You
actually looked pretty
that,
good.
Huh?
No, I hadn't expected that. You might be able to compete with Arnold. But the two favorite
in
was,
my prime.
Right, Arnold posing together with Franco Colombo. Franco, who's 5'2" approximately, right?
Now, and steroid use was not it wasn't even illegal at the time.
I don't believe it was illegal, and it was certainly commonly used.
Yeah.
And so some of the guys would go to Mexico, I think, apparently, to get it. But I don't think it was a big deal.
We have dropped most of the strands now, steroid use, political activism, women in sports, and we will tie them all together as my conversation with Jen Boxall, who is the director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. Haven't even talked about that yet. More on that in a moment on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. I'm talking today with Jen Boxall. She's director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. She has written extensively on sports ethics and gender equity in sports. And as we're learning, Jen is not stuck in the ivory tower of the academy. Jen practices what she preaches. She was a college athlete and a college coach. Tell me about coaching.
Coaching was a lot of fun. After playing, wasn't really a lot for women to do, obviously, but I did play in the Los Angeles City League, which has A, B, C, D, A when you first come out of college and pretty competitive, and so then B down, and so I think I stopped at B, and then we moved to Tampa, Florida, by way of Kentucky. So I coached at a couple of high school Christian schools, and then at the University of Tampa, I was the head coach for 5 years there. And that was pretty interesting, a lot more difficult than I had anticipated, but it's kind of like teaching, right? And so for me, it was an easy transition in one way. But the difference of coaching girls, especially at that year, this was from 80 to 85, that parents, don't think, which is still the case perhaps to a certain extent, that women really know much about sports. And so parents know, especially fathers, know a lot more than what you do, and why isn't my daughter playing? That was probably the biggest difficulty. I loved it, actually. It was a lot of fun. I liked the recruiting because you got to meet families. But while I liked it, it's a 24-hour job. Mm. You're at their beck and call. And so it was difficult to have family. And by that time, I had two children. And so it was difficult, but certainly a lot of fun. And would I want to do it now? No. I might do an assistant, but I could never be a head coach.
You talked about the importance of, or some of the interesting effects that Title IX has had, particularly on women in coaching.
Right. I think that Title IX, as many people know, came about in 1972. So, and then just about that year, maybe in 71, there were women playing sports in colleges, more than when I was playing in the late 60s. And at that time, I would well over 90% of the women's sports were coached and run, administered by women. Now it's less, it's about 40% in Division I. And so it's a lot less than it was after the passage of Title IX. And I think because, we certainly didn't get paid a lot, and we did it because we loved it. And, some of us were really quite good. And it was so at that time, there was one team in our conference, and this is at the University of Tampa, and it's a Division II school, so it's a Sunshine State Conference. I think there was one male coach. All the rest were females. And certainly all the administrating of women's sports was done by women.
So it's ironically had the effect of moving women out of coaching spots and some of the administrative
right.
spots.
Right. Certainly a great deal more participation, right? Probably fivefold. I mean, it's really the number of women participating is greater. But I think there's a lot of reasons. One, money, right? Men had no interest in doing it with females before because there was no money in it. And I think also there still is the stereotype and the perception that men, when it comes to sports, it's a men's bailiwick. And so I think it's certainly more men are into it. And I even ask my students today, when you think athlete, what do you think? And I would say that 90% of them think men.
Well, and could this be a kind of a leapfrog effect in the sense that when all of a sudden Title IX makes women's athletics mainstream, that means men might be interested.
Correct.
Well, there's a larger pool of really experienced men. And then as more women participate, that you rebuild an equilibrium.
That's certainly the case. I think there were more men ready at hand, waiting to, ready to do this. Sure, certainly. And because there wasn't really a lot to draw from, there were certainly some good schools like Old Dominion had always been a pretty good at women's sports. And Kathy Rush, I forgot where she was now, in New Jersey. But the schools that were in Prairie View A&M, there were schools that did have some good women's basketball in particular, which is the one I'm most familiar with. But there were schools that did have a lot of women's sports, and you know, they were few and far between. And so, but there were a lot more men available, certainly.
So let's talk about the importance of sports to society. Mm-hmm. You edited a volume of essays mm-hmm. on this, and one of the essayists pointed out that everybody from Plato to Camus has talked about
right.
how important sports are to society. Are they?
Yes. I think they're important in the sense, even if you hate them, they affect you. So the why I think they're important is because they play a significant role in our society in a lot of ways. I think we can see the development of morality in them as well. But I think for me, they're the best as why, as a kid, it was the one means for me to have self-development, to self-respect. I knew who I was, and I could be who I was. And I think that's it served that, and I think it still does that. It's the biggest and it's the most significant activity that allows people to self-develop, develop self-respect, and also achieve self-esteem. Do we sometimes take it to extremes? Yes. This is why I write about it.
Well, you talked about two things there, and I'd like to separate them for a moment. One is this business of self-development, coming into yourself mm-hmm. through overcoming the challenges. Mm-hmm. And the other is developing character. I think you used the word morality.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stick with that one first, because it seems to me the tricky thing there is whose morality, whose values, whose ethics?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a good point. I think one of the things that I want to maintain is that there's one thing that we all desire, and that's self-respect. Right? And in that, it also develops respect for others. And so for me, the ideal of sport, granted, there's the ideal and then the practice of it, and we can have ideals of anything, and the practice is always going to be different. But the ideal is that it does develop the self-respect and respect for others. When played as a competition, as I call it, and one of my colleagues who also writes in Ethics in Sports, a mutual challenge to achieve excellence. If you look at it that way, it's not that you're looking for the victory. You are. Of course, you're playing to win, but that isn't the only thing you do. At home, we didn't care who won. I mean, we kind of did, right? But certainly, as soon as you keep score, you know that you're tallying up and there's going to be a winner at the end. But in the participation of it, you recognize that you can't do these without each other, right? You can't win without the other team. So it develops a respect, and this is why I ask, you know, when you shake hands at the end of a game, what is it you're actually saying? What you're saying is, thanks, friend, for the challenge, because I couldn't have done it without you. And so you can't begin the game, continue the game, or even win the game without others. So to recognize that others are essential as partners, right? And I think it's not that they're enemies to be defeated, but they're partners for you to allow yourself and them to develop into what they can be.
Well, don't we send a mixed message, though, in this particular society, particularly because we have a kind of win-at-all-costs ethic that I think infuses business, the academy,
yes.
and so why not
right.
sports? And we reward people on the basis of their personal right. excellence. It's what you achieved in your stardom. And isn't that in conflict?
We do, it is in conflict. And I think once you take the once the end of the game is outside the game itself, right? So one of the things I argue is that sports is one of those activities which is an end in itself. It has no significance outside of that game, right? And when you look at the development of basketball, which I think is an interesting history, most of the rules were initially developed pretty serendipitously, right? The gym was just the gym at Springfield. The height of the basket was the rafter. Okay, which, mm-hmm. interestingly, is probably the only rule that remains the same of the original rules.
Really?
Right. So when I ask that, too, right, most people, there is the jump at the beginning, but that's a little bit different. But I think that what is it that, why do we design these rules? We design them to make you have to develop who you are, to challenge your physical as well as mental, right, to be the best you can be. But once now you take it outside of the end for money, you now begin to manipulate the rules for that end, and that we have done. It's, you know, and I know that some people will say that winning at all costs, but basically nobody who participates really wants to win at all costs. I shouldn't say nobody. Most people don't want to win at all costs because there are lots of things you would do if you wanted to win at all costs, right? So one thing you would all do is the easiest thing to do, play against somebody you know you can beat. Right, but you wouldn't want to
Let's
do that.
Take a look at the opening few games for the big college basketball. But never mind.
Exactly.
Never mind.
No, that's right. So you do take on teams as you're developing.
Yeah.
But you don't. You notice now, right. Division One, for instance, you can't use the Division Two games as in your record for that very reason. Right. And so you do want to develop your teams. As I was on the other end as a Division II coach, right? Our team was one that all the division schools wanted, one schools would play. So I've known Debbie Ryan from Virginia, for instance. She would always come down because, of course, in the wintertime, it's nicer in Tampa than it is, right? So we would get a lot of teams who just wanted to test their team. And it was also a way of having improving our budget because we had no budget. But once I think you do add an even victory, when you make victory the main thing, it also begins to change it. And that's where I think, as we've seen just in all the sports, and I think that's not significant now. It's certainly from ancient times as well.
What do you make of the fact that, again, if you examine this question from a slightly different point of view, athletes probably would take all kinds of dangerous drugs if they weren't outlawed. We have to make a rule because they on their own wouldn't decide not to take them.
I'm really at odds with that. And I think that I have mixed feelings. One, I don't think they would, okay? Because I don't think I would. Right?
But they did.
They did. But I don't think all athletes would,
okay.
Right? And so I think that if you allow... One of the few arguments that I can see that makes any sense is that if you allow all of them to take whatever they'd like to take, then it will coerce others to do something that they would normally not,
okay.
and it wouldn't really self-develop. I mean, now it would be too harmful. We do make rules to protect the student, to protect the players, right? We wear helmets, right? And then you look at the helmets from the 60s to now, it's very different. So one of the things why we change rules is to prevent harm to the participants, but also prevent harm to others. And so, yes, we can say, you know, let them take whatever they want, right, to see how best they can be. And I think in many ways, society doesn't care. Right.
Well, society seems indifferent at a certain level. And it is true that the excuse that you'll hear from the athletes who took it is, well, I got to do it to compete.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I wouldn't have been chosen. I wouldn't be on this team. So there's a lot of risky behavior that is pushed by, it seems to me, the economics. Can we put the genie back in the bottle? Is there a way to get back to the pure
Well,
form?
I think this is why the anti-doping agency, both the world and the U.S. anti-doping agency, has been developed, as well as other countries, to sort of try to do that. And what they've realized is testing and all these other things and penalties don't really do the trick. And this is why one of the focus is supposed to be on education. And so this is what they're now trying to do, is maybe educate that really people don't realize that it's harm. So it harms me, you know, it's only going to be for a short period of time. And let's face it, does sports harm? I mean, you get broken legs, you get broken all kinds of things. So there is those kinds of harm. But I think once you add drugs, and it might be, you know, the similar with other kinds of drugs, it's a different kind of thing. And I haven't really... come to terms with that yet. But I do think that the biggest thing is to recognize harm to self and harm to others.
So you said you wanted to get in the air. One of the things you wanted to do in the Air Force was be in the Radio Corps, right? And they wouldn't let you do that.
Right.
But you got to be an announcer, both on the radio and as a PA announcer for women's basketball.
I did. And actually, again, a lot of things that I've done has come about just because things have been available, and taken advantage of resources that were just happened to be there for me, or create them when they weren't. But when I came, we came to North Carolina in 1985, and I just finished coaching. And it's like playing and coaching. Once you leave it, it's like withdrawal. So I went to the then women's basketball coach, Jennifer Alley, and I said, look, I'll do anything. I'll help you assist. I also did the play-by-play for the men's games, typing it for Tampa. And so I said, look, I'll do stats. I'll do whatever. And so she says, well, I just lost our we need a PA announcer. Do you want to do it? I said, sure. I've never done it, but I'll try.
How'd you
so
like
that was
it?
In 1965, yeah,
you must
and I
have
loved
it. Yeah.
Exactly. A little nervous at first, but you know, but it was lots and lots of fun. I really like it.
Do you get this? I hear this all the time from folks who feel that it's just okay to say this when they talk about women's sports announcers, particularly in traditionally men's sports. They just sort of shudder and shake their head and say, "Get them off of there. They don't belong there."
Well, I do think it's there certainly, and I heard that as well. But I think a lot has to do with the voice, but also I think What's the goal that they're trying to do with having the female announcers? And I think now it's nowhere near as bad as it was. I think you see lots of them, even in football.
You are more competent. They actually
much more competent. Yes.
You even did announcing at the Olympics in Atlanta.
I did, and it's probably the next to Martin Luther King. That's probably the second most significant outside the marrying my husband and having children, right? But I had done, of course, the announcing since 85 at Carolina, and then I also did some for the ACC tournament and also for the ABL, women's basketball, before the WNBA. And so I did some announcing for them as well, and then later for the WNBA in Charlotte as well. But they invited me initially to do field hockey, because I also do field hockey at UNC, which I've done for many years as well. But there was still I was holding out for the option of doing basketball, and I did. And so was invited in 96 to do the announcing.
Was that scary? Come on, that's the
scary,
whole.
Scary, yes, it was. It was also very exciting because it was the first and only female, so that was good. Wow. I was the only non-professional. In other words, all the others were announcers. One was from the Houston Rockets, one was from Toronto. I forgot that there were four of us who did them. And all of the other were three men from the NBA.
And you were now, that was the dream team, right?
My very first game was the men's dream team. Yes. Wow. So, and I know that the guys were really jealous. I actually, in the end, gave up. One guy didn't get many of the dream team. So I gave up one so that I could go watch the field hockey final games, which wasn't far away. So, but there were 92 games at the Olympics. I called 25. I did 25 and watched 88 of them. So, In other words, I watched basketball for 2 weeks solid. So, but I did both the men's and women's and did do all the medal rounds for the women. So that was fun.
Well, Jan, we'll have to have you back for another hour just to explain the rules of field hockey. Do that and the rest of your life, which we haven't quite gotten to. But thank you for sharing this much.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Jan Boxall is senior lecturer and director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. And that's our program for today. It's The State of Things, and you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program that is produced by Lindsay Thomas and Rachel McCarthy, with help from John Hill and Charles Duncan Pardo. Robin Copley is our technical director. The managing editor is Katie Barron. Susan Davis is our senior producer. Our theme music, written by Django Haskins. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.